Thank you.
I'll put it down from there. Rosh Smardasa, Rabbi Fried, thank you very much for the introductory remarks and the warm words. And really the introduction about Achdus also. I want to thank Norman Rosenfeld and the whole committee for the invitation setting up this evening. And above all, I want to thank everyone for coming out tonight. Stama Tuesday night. It's nice to see everyone. It's my first time in this shul, I think, in this part of Brooklyn. But as you know, there are many branches of this shul in my shul in Teaneck in Bnei Yeshurun. Yak Berenholt sends regards, by the way. He found out I'm coming here. So it's nice to see where, for so many of my members, it all started here. The Shorashim, the roots, are here. I entitled the lecture tonight, Many Communities, One Nation. Kilot Rabot Am Echad. Many communities. The fact is, we all know that Jewish people are many different communities, but we're one nation. And our ability to coexist as one nation really is the challenge that's before us, not only today, but historically as well. And as Rabbi Fried said so eloquently, there's nothing new. Achdus has been a challenge since the beginning of Klal Yisrael. You know, we started saying Tachnun again on Sunday, 2 days ago. We only hope through Yisro Chag, but I see you didn't say Tachnun here this afternoon because we're still in the Yemei Tashlumen for the Yom Tov of Shavuos. As we came to our Sinai, the Torah says very tellingly, Vayichan Shom Yisrael Neged Ahor. And Israel encamped there, opposite the mountain. And Rashi comments, quoting the Gemara, that Yisrael is understood as if it's in the singular, not Vayachanu, and they encamped, but he encamped, it encamped, Lashon Yochid. So Rashi says that's because they came Ki Ish Echad B'Lev Echad, one person with one heart, complete dedication, complete symmetry of destiny, of values, of goals. We're all together. And yet, right before that, just 6 weeks before, at Yam Suf, the Torah uses similar language about the Egyptians who were pursuing us. Vayirdof Mitzrayim achareihem. Egypt chased, but Egypt is also singular, not plural. And there Rashi says the same language, but in reverse. Belev echad kiish echad. Not like one person with one heart, but like one heart is one person. What's the difference in the two? So I think it's Rav Huttner who said that the unity of the Egyptians was not a normal, not a natural unity. Lev echad there means they needed a cause. They needed something to unite them, to bring them together. What brings together many of the nations of the world, say in the Middle East? Hatred of Klal Yisrael. They may fight amongst themselves, and they do. You should probably encourage it also. Better for us. They fight amongst themselves. They have less capability to attack the Jewish people. But in fact, when they unite, what unites them is always Sinas Yisrael. So it's not a natural unity. It's a unity that's engendered by a common enemy. The Jewish people are completely different. Vayichan Shom Yisrael Neged Ahor, our unity is a natural unity. At Sinai, we were like one person. We had one goal, one objective, one HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem Echad, giving us the Torah. We may be disparate communities, but in fact, we have a common bond, many common bonds, but especially the bond of Torah and the bond of Jewish identity. That's the good news. The bad news is the last time we're in that state of complete unity was at Sinai. 3,326 years ago. Since then, unity has been much more difficult to engender in Jewish life. So it is our natural state. In fact, Rashi there says, when he says that Vayichan Sham Yisrael Kiish Echad Balev Echad. So Rashi himself notes, Avo Bishar Chanayos, all the other encampments that we had, Bitar Omes Uva Machlokes, there with acrimony, strife. And it doesn't only mean the encampments during our sojourn in the wilderness. It means our encampments wherever we've been since that day. We're always riven by some type of dissension, by different views, by people trying to move in different directions, sometimes even stretch the Torah in different directions, but certainly even having occasionally different conceptions of what Jewish destiny should be, what Jewish nationalism is, what's the essence of Torah. And that really is the topic tonight. Where are we today in terms of our ability to forge a commonality of interests, a unity between the Jewish people, given that we have so many different communities? I'll leave out the community that's outside the Torah world. They're also Jews, but it's a different discussion. And we need different mechanisms in order to keep them close and bring them back. I'm talking within the religious world. And if you want to just remove it from our context, go to the religious world in Eretz Yisrael and look at the different varieties that exist of religious Jews. You have Haredi. You have what's called Haredi light, a little more open to college studies, say. You have Chardal, Haredi Lumi. You have Haredim in practice, but they're much more nationalistic. You have Chardal light, okay? You have Dati Lumi, settlers. Dati Torani, even Dati Liberali, which, you know, is really skirting the line of Torah, but nonetheless, they consider themselves part of our world. In the Edot HaMizrach, many different groupings. Most of us are Ashkenazim here, so we come almost to the Jewish world with an Ashkenazo-centric attitude. But the fact is, I've seen this in our own community, it's very difficult for Moroccans, Yemenites, Libyans, Egyptians, Syrians, Tunisians to daven together. The nusach is different. Sometimes the nigunim are different. Can't lump them all together. Nonetheless, we're also pious Jews, also part of the Torah world. So how then do we bring everything together? I think we have to start with the good news, especially in Eretz Yisrael. In Israel, the pure Chiloni that hated Torah, wanted nothing to do with it, was imbued with some socialist ethos, that Israeli is in the decline. They still exist. They're limited really to the media, where you think their numbers are much greater than they are, but they're not a very powerful force, but for the cultural influences they're able to wield through the media. But you take the average Israeli, they have no hatred for Torah. Sometimes they have an ignorance of Torah, but they have no hatred of it. They want to learn. If it's presented to them in a proper way, non-threatening, loving, V'harav Nashem Elokeinu, Zdivrei Hasechem Afinu, we have to make the words of Torah orev, pleasant, beautiful, nice, pleasing. If the words are pleasant, so they're receptive to it. And you'd be shocked how many people that we would construe as secular Israelis come to Shiurim every week just to learn, want to have a taste of Shabbos. Kashrus is relatively easy there. A taste of Shabbos, a taste of the Yom Tovim. They want it for themselves. But we have to present a pleasant face of Torah in order that they should want to be part of that world. I think in our world, because the similarities between all the groups I mentioned are so enormous, the similarities are enormous. Tarag mitzvahs, the 613 commandments, are 613 commandments for all of us. It's all the same. So the distinctions are magnified. And especially in Israel, I guess it's true in our world as well, dress takes on great significance. As if you could define a person by this type of hat or this type of yarmulke or jacket or coat or beard or dress or other type of head covering. You really can't. It's the surface. That's the uniform. It's almost the team that you want to identify with. Maybe different teams, but everyone's in the same league. And there's great institutional loyalty as well. Recognize that. This shul, this shtibel, this yeshiva, this kolel, etc. But if you take all those different entities, all right, and anyone here would walk in to any of them, whether it's here or in Israel, you can't daven Ma'ariv, the same Mincha, the same Shacharis, I've given a V'yasmach Pergune here or there, easy adjustment to make. Well, daven, Shabbos starts the same time for all of us. Doesn't always end the same time, but it starts the same time. It's the same Torah. So things that really are superficial, are externals, take on a much greater significance than they have. So there are differences. But here's another bit of good news. Shouldn't romanticize the past. There are always differences. Especially whenever any Jewish population in any given locale or geographical entity reached a critical mass. Were there no differences between religious Jews in the 19th century? Right, none of you here lived through it. I concede that. Neither did I. But just think about it. It was worse than it is today. The disputes between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. Between the maskilim who rejected Torah and the frum maskilim who was shomrei mitzvos. Between Rav Hirsch in Frankfurt and the Lithuanian, Polish, Rosh Yeshiva in Eastern Europe. Even in Germany, the Austrit separated Rav Hirsch's camp from the camp of Rav Bamberger and others. The Musar movement, it's so hard for us to believe, but the Musar movement engendered tremendous opposition, sometimes violent opposition, hostility, fights within yeshivas, whether they should set aside time to strive for ethical perfection, including episodes we know about, yeshivas had to be closed because factions were throwing chairs at each other. In a Beis Medrash, and then late in the 19th century, early 20th century, you had the Zionists and the Bundists and the Socialists and the Communists and the Anarchists and the Religious Zionists and the Anti-Zionists. I'll tell you, it was much worse then than it is now. So we're living in a golden era of sorts. So we disagree on certain things? No. And the media makes it out to be as if a war is going on? No. They could say, they could write whatever they want. The bottom line is, the Metzius is not that. The reality is not that. See, here's another bit of good news. There's nothing that divides the frum world today that didn't divide us 100 years ago. All right? 1914. Just in 2-3 weeks, the anniversary of World War I will be commemorated. There's nothing that existed in the Jewish world then that doesn't exist now. Ota geveret b'shinui aderet. Same woman, different dress. And I'll explain. It's the same sides. It's the same issues. It's really the same arguments. Of course, updated a little for our time. But the fact is we survived 110 years with them. These arguments are not fatal. I'll elaborate in a moment, but we should be careful to update them so that we're not trapped in the past and we're not using language or nomenclature that's not really appropriate for our day. Sometimes I read in the Haredi press, and I you don't hear this from the Gedolim, But you read in the Haredi press that they'll address or try to address modern problems by referencing Ben-Gurion. As I read that, my eyes tend to glaze over. Ben-Gurion is dead more than 40 years. He's out of power more than 50 years. He has no influence anymore. He has no heirs. In fact, I think his heirs live in New York. So he plays little role in modern Israeli society. And even his protege, his main protege, Shimon Peres, has gone in a different direction. I'll give you an example. 100 years ago, many Gedolim, if not most Gedolim, felt that Zionism was evil, was anti-Torah. Nothing would come out of it. It couldn't. It was born, as they saw it, in a rebellion against the Torah, a continuation of the Haskalah, of the emancipation, of the rise of secular nationalism in Europe in the 19th century. There's nothing holy about it. In the 1930s, the Chafetz Chaim said, "Im Hashem," quoting the pasuk in Tehillim, "Im Hashem lo yivne bayis, shavam lubonav bo." Pasuk says, if God is not going to build the house, the workers toil in vain. And he thought nothing would come of it because of that. But the Chafetz Chaim have said the same thing 10 years later, 20 years later. I don't think so. He saw the Holocaust coming, by the way. But he saw the U.S., the United States, as the refuge and not Israel. Would he have said the same thing in 1950? I assume not. Rav Hirsch, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, said in wrote about 1880. He said in these words, these are the words he used, "Germany is our motherland, and it will remain our motherland ad bias Mashiach Tzidkenu." Would he have said that 50 years later? 60 years later? 70 years later after the Holocaust? I don't think so. If we freeze the Gedolim of the past and repeat as if it's current events what they said 100, 150 years ago, then we undermine their greatness and we do them a disservice. Rav Hirsch was an anti-Zionist. That was their derech in Germany in the 19th century. He was an anti-Zionist. Would he be an anti-Zionist 70 years later? Would he still consider Germany the motherland at Bias Mashiach Tzidkenu? I would assume not. In 1950, one of the Torah giants in Israel said, the non-Zionist, that the state would not last 15 years. It wasn't correct. It did. So the sides today that exist, that we think are roiling our world, they all existed in 1914. Basically, you had the three establishments. You had the anti-religious amongst the Zionists. You had the religious Zionists, Mizrahi, which had started about a decade earlier. And you had the Haredim. The only change is that then early Aguda was anti-Zionist. Like Hungarian Orthodoxy dominated their perspective. But Aguda changed after the Holocaust, to their credit. They even joined the government at first in 1948. Then they, you know, sort of hedged their bets. But I would characterize them fairly, without any animus at all, as non-Zionists. Anyone who says they're pro-Zionist is wrong. Anyone who says they're anti-Zionist is just as wrong. They're not anti-Zionist. They're non-Zionist. They don't take a position for reasons we'll get to in a little while. But look at the three groups. Then the anti-religious were the socialist Zionists, the heirs to Herzl, then Weizmann, then Ben-Gurion. So they don't really exist anymore, socialists. That's, except in Berkeley and Harvard, socialism is not really a political theory that's popular in the world today. So they're best represented today by Yair Lapid. But Yair Lapid is not his father. His father grew up religious Jew, yeshiva student, and Nebuch, he was a survivor of the Holocaust, completely lost his faith, and became bitter when he saw his family murdered in the Holocaust. But he's not his father. He doesn't have those experiences. He's not a lover of Torah. All I could tell you, he has an appreciation for it as a cultural thing. He's worthy of kirovs, no doubt about it. But he represents, I would say, the anti-religious establishment only because he proposes a secular Jewish state, purely secular. And he recoils from the notion of the integration of religion and state, like exists here in America, this separation. He wants in Israel too. That's the extent of the anti-religious establishment that exists in Israel today, for the most part. The religious Zionists then, 100 years ago, then it was Mizrahi, so today we call them Dati Lumi. And Aguda, the Haredi world, as I mentioned a moment ago, they essentially split, a majority non-Zionist, and they have a minority, the mainly Hungarian Hasidim, a minority remains anti-Zionist. But basically, though, it's the same people, their descendants, with the exact same ideologies. We're arguing over the exact same thing. We're just a little older, 100 years older, no worse the wear. So what exactly are they arguing about? Now, I would hasten to add that all three groups are necessary to some extent. They add something to Klal Yisrael. Certainly those who are outside the camp of Torah, but build the state, fight for the state, are motivated by Jewish nationalism, so that's also mitzvah Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Rashtem es Eretz Yishavtem bo. That was Rav Kook's great breakthrough. Maybe they're performing a mitzvah unknowingly, all right? They're misasek b'mitzvah, but they're misasek b'mitzvah. And it's to their eternal credit that they are, and they did. So you have these three groups, but again, keep in mind, since Sinai, we really have not been monolithic, all right? Grant you. Maybe it survived a little, but certainly since the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash era. There are different approaches within the Torah world. None is perfect, but it's all perfect together. Unless you curse me as a pluralist, God forbid. So there are obviously approaches to Torah that are outside the system, that are beyond the pale, that we don't accept, that are illegitimate. That's what Chazal say, there's Shivim Panim, the Torah. There's 70 different facets to Torah. But 70 means there's 70. There's not 71 or 72 or 80. There's certain things that are outside the pale. It's Shivim Panim La Torah, not Panim Ein Sof La Torah. Not everything a person, a Jew, says is part of Torah simply because he said it. It's Shivim Panim, and we analyze carefully what is, what isn't, which is part of Torah, which is not. We can argue over that. But within the Torah world, there's tremendous variety. There's different colors. There's even different hashkafos. So the main difference of which you're arguing today, going back a century and alive and well, is the attitude towards Jewish nationalism. There's some who felt 100 years ago, some still feel that way today, that it's muktzah machmas miyus, you can't touch it, it's bad, it came from a bad place outside our world. So the roots are bad. If the roots are poisonous, it's whatever's today is the fruit of the poisonous tree. The extent we have to accommodate it or not, so that's also part of the discussion. But that's one segment of our society that's existed over a century already. Some felt like that 100 years ago, as I noted, but now take a much more nuanced position. And this really was a debate they had again 66 years ago. It's a long time. 1948, when hundreds of Gedolim and Rosh Yeshiva urged people to vote in the Knesset elections to the consternation and horror of the Satmar Rebbe. If you don't believe me, get a sefer at Kufa HaGedolah of Rav Menachem Kasher Zatzal. It's appended usually to Kol HaTor. He has not only the letter, the proclamation that they signed in 1948, the Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva, go vote, but he has pages and pages, 5-6 pages in small print of the Rosh Yeshiva, the Hasidic Rebbeim, who said we have to have our voice heard. By the way, that was maturity, because just 20 years earlier, it was 1927, 26, 27, 28, the British decided to form a national council that the Jewish people should have a representative body in Israel under the British mandate. And unfortunately, it was the second time it happened in a decade and a half. The Haredi world, led by Rav Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, decided to boycott the National Council. So you had basically there, you had the socialists, social Zionists, you had the revisionist Zionists of Jabotinsky, and you had the religious Zionists, Mizrahi. The Haredi voice was not heard because they excluded themselves. It's a bad practice. Had their voice been heard, I happen to think the whole color of the state would have been different. But again, they said no, and the decisions were made without reference to what they wanted. But nonetheless, most want to participate. So without rehashing that argument, which still rages from time to time, to one degree or another, those who departed from the traditional Aguda anti-Zionism and are now non-Zionists, they've basically been on the fence since then. Not supportive of Zionism or the Jewish national state, not antagonistic, dismissive at times of it, but generally accepting of it since they take funds from the government. It's a different world then, of course, but in 1948, Haredim fought in the army. You can see it in pictures and newsreels of the time. And why wouldn't they? Pikuach Nefesh. They didn't know how the war would turn out. They also had an interest in living. It's also part of Torah. Ben-Gurion had not yet made his arrangement with the Chazon Ish. It was so soon after the Holocaust. I'd like to stand here and tell you that Ben-Gurion made his arrangement with the Chazon Ish to exempt yeshiva students from military service because he wanted to rebuild Torah after the Holocaust. I'd like to say that it's not true. The reason why he did it was predicated on one notion. He did not think Torah would survive another generation. So let them be. It's a couple of hundred people. Let them be. Avoid the tumult and they'll die out. One more generation, they would disappear. Boy, was he wrong. He was wrong big time. But now you come to an issue, of course, that's been in our on our radar the last couple of years, but you know, it's been latent in Israel for at least two or three decades now, and that is the Haredi military service or national service, or better said, making a national contribution to the Jewish people. So, again, the arrangement was made. Neither Ben-Gurion nor the Chazon Ish anticipated that would extend eventually to tens of thousands of people. But it has to be dealt with. And it has to be dealt with for the best of reasons. The return to Eretz Yisrael, the reestablishment of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel, after 19 centuries, unprecedented in the history of the world, that should happen to a nation. Unprecedented. And therefore something that, with all our tefillos and all our yearnings for Geula, we never fully reckoned with that reality and the ramifications of that reality. So we've been a little slow in adapting the Torah to the needs of a modern state. How long was it in Jewish life from the last time we needed Hilchot Tzava, the laws of an army? It's been quite a while, all right? Bar Kochva's time, quite a while. It's a little sefer I carry with me, a Yoman, a diary. It's a dvar handed out by the tens of thousands of soldiers in the army. A little Dvar Torah, it's 7 days a week, so some of it is Hashkafa, some of it's Halacha that relate to the soldiers, a little on the Parshas, other Halachas, etc. So, I look at it every morning, davening finishes, a little Torah. Today's question dealt with this issue. Let's say soldiers are going out on a mission right around the time of Shkia, when Shabbos comes. Should they make Shabbos early, all right, so they can daven, have Kiddush, Motzi, and then go out on their mission? Or they should they try to delay Shabbos as much as possible even though they might not be able to make Kiddush till much later that night, maybe not until the next morning, etc. So the army actually has, of course, a very talented Rabbanut, Rabbanut Tzvait. This question went many years ago to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and he said, better to delay Shabbos. No, don't start Shabbos early. If you start Shabbos early, then you may come to do preparations for the mission that are not vital, and you'll be Michal Shabbos. You might as well wait as much as possible, even though you might not be able to daven Meir, say Kabbalah Shabbos, make Kiddush until much later on. My point is not to discuss the halacha, which, you know, sounds very good to me. Not that it needs my askama. When is the last time Jews had to deal with such a question? It's a good 19 centuries ago. And that's a prok. That's just a small detail of what entails maintaining a Jewish army in the modern world. Not to mention every other facet of national life, all right? There's a sefer that Rav Goren wrote on many of these issues. Think about it. Someone is a spy for the Mossad. He's posted overseas. To what extent can he or she violate certain halachos in order to infiltrate the community that needs to be infiltrated? All right? These questions are not am. This week is Parshas Shlach, right? The Meraglim that Moshe sent had it easy. The Meraglim that Yeshua sent 40 years later had it easy also. It's not as easy today. But all these questions need to be dealt with. So we are, truth be told, uncomfortable with the notion of having Talmid Chachamim, of having Tzaddikim carry a gun, go into combat, risk their lives, etc. Because we have no recent role models of that prototype. The most recent that I know of goes back almost 11 centuries. Harav Shmuel HaNagid. If you have Shmuel HaNagid, he was the vizier, chief of staff in Granada, in Spain, to one of the Muslim kings. He maintained the yeshiva in Granada. He was a Rosh Yeshiva there. He wrote the Mevo HaTalmud that you see in the Vilna Shas in Maseches Brachos. And after he finished the shir in the morning, he'd go out to the battlefield. Because he was the chief of staff, all right? We have such role models. We're Jews who, fought in God's army. Avraham Avinu, Moshe Rabbeinu, Yahshua Ben Nun, David HaMelech, etc. So they were the leaders. But if you think the Parshas Devarim, in Parshas Shoftim, who do we send? Who do we not send to battle? Who do we not send? Mioish Hayorei V'rach HaLevav. The person who's fearful, who's soft of heart, who therefore might induce panic in his fellow soldiers if he panics. Why is this person afraid? Yeah, the obvious reasons. Rabbi Akiva says the obvious reasons. Rabbi Yosef Gluli says no. Yo hayore me averos shebiyodo. He's afraid of the sins that he's committed, that there'll be punishment reaped upon him on the battlefield. What type of sin are we talking about? What does the Gemara say? Someone who speaks between Yishtabach and Baruch Hu. That's the type of sin. I know we should all start shaking now. That's the type of sin that a person would say, if he committed that, then he's exempt from battle. Who's going to battle? Tzaddikim are going to battle. Yirei Shamayim are going to battle. Talmid Chachamim are going to battle. That's the nature of Jewish life. There was a famous British general. His name was Sir William Francis Butler. Died in 1910. Who said something, actually borrowed from Thucydides, the Greek historian. I just saw this yesterday. He said that the state that separates its scholars from its warriors will have its thinking done by cowards and it's fighting done by fools. Think about it. Thucydides goes back over 2,500 years, all right? Butler's died a little over a century ago. The scholar warrior is an image, a role model, a prototype in Jewish life. I'll grant you, It's been dormant for quite some time. I'm privileged in my capacity to meet many Rosh Yeshiva in Israel, some of the heads of the Hesli Yeshivot. One I know in the Modi'in is still a colonel in active doing reserve duty, Rav Shenvold. Colonel, bird colonel, fought in the last Lebanon War. Leaves yeshiva when he has to and goes to fight. He's not the only one that doesn't like this. Not all were majors and colonels, some are sergeants and lieutenants. All right? But that image exists. We don't see it necessarily. We haven't seen it for a long time, but it really is something natural in Jewish life. The problem really is, and the two issues. Rabbi Wein wrote something a few weeks ago, and I grew up in Muncie, so I still dote on every word that Rabbi Wein says. He said that the problem really in the Haredi world, I say this out of love, I mean, I try to love all Jews. Some Jews make it hard on me, but I try to love all Jews. Rabbi Wein said the two most important events that occurred in Jewish history in the 20th century, the Holocaust and the establishment of the State of Israel, two events that really were sui generis, unprecedented, one a horror, one a celebration, the two major events are for the most part still ignored by the Haredi world. They don't celebrate, they don't celebrate the state, they don't mourn the Holocaust, they do their own things. For decades, there was no response at all. It took really to the 70s, 80s even, for there to be any type of response. The response, as we know, it's all proper. Focusing on the acts of spiritual heroism that took place amongst the survivors and some of the victims, Nebuch, of the Holocaust. And tremendous acts. I mean, Jews, moser nefesh, in ways that... to a commoner like myself, are still mind-boggling. Tremendous stories. I don't get too off-topic. Rav Lazer Silver, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, tell the story. He was the head of the Agudas Rabbanim for many, many years. Became a chaplain, unofficial, of course, in the American Army. Went to the camps after the Holocaust ended. It's a famous story. I'll be brief. He came into one of the camps. Everyone came to daven, it was a Shabbos, and a Jew came, refused to open a siddur. Bitter, bitter. And Rabbi Lazer Silva said to him, "What's wrong?" Besides the obvious. And he said, "He can't get over this. He was from before, he lost everything, but there was one act that he saw, he was in Auschwitz, that he could not get over, that turned him off Torah Jewry." It must have been Hungarian Jew, it was 1944 already, late 44, smuggled a siddur into Auschwitz, and he sold the right to use the siddur for 2 or 3 minutes for a scrap of bread. And Jews in the back lined up to give him their morsel of bread so they should be able to daven. So this guy was so turned off by that, he said, how does this guy use his religion, use the Torah, in order to extract morsels of bread from religious Jews? It's despicable, and I want nothing to do with it. So Blazer Silver is a Kluger's tremendously clever person, said to him, why do you focus on the Jew who sold the siddur for bread? Why don't you focus on all the Jews who gave their daily bread so they should daven for a siddur? Isn't that even more inspirational? And the man broke down crying. So again, there are many stories like this. They're all proper. I wouldn't say that's the essence of the Holocaust, though. And so what happened was they basically absented themselves from that type of discussion. So neither event is really commemorated or marked. There's still great intellectual and emotional discomfort with it. And many have noted, I think it's obvious, you even see this sometimes in the writing, some segments of the society treat the Israeli government the same way we used to treat the governments in Europe, as if you need shtadlonim, and you have private deals, and occasionally shtick, and draft evasion, that's a problem. That's a conceptual problem, besides a moral problem. Because the state of Israel is not an extension of the Golos. It's something new in our lives. Something wondrous happened in our world. So I understand not everyone likes the way the Ribono Shel Olam brought about the restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the last generation, but it's his world, it's not our world, and we don't get to choose how he does these things. I mean, think about it. We're living through Kibbutz Golios. We're living through it. We could read all the Nevi'im. They speak about it. They prophesy it. The bottom line is, we're living through it now. Our turn will come also, eventually. We're living through it. Zain Balnes, Makir Beniso. All right, because we don't like the way, we didn't think it would involve having to buy a ticket. Well, Nefesh B'Nevi, you don't have to buy a ticket. We didn't think it would be this way. We thought it would be a different way. But again, it's not our choice. So I think the fact that they have not yet reconciled themselves to a way of dealing with both the Holocaust and the state begets the second problem. Lapid launched his political career about 3-4 years ago with a speech that he gave at the Ono Haredi College. If you have internet, Google Lapid Ono College. You understand Hebrew, you'll appreciate it. Maybe. It's a challenge. Because what he said to the Haredim in the audience, the Haredi College, he said, in essence, Nitzachtem. You won. You won. Ben-Gurion was wrong. You didn't disappear. It's the opposite. You're going to soon be the majority in Israel. All right? 70%, I just saw a reporter told me this figure this morning, 70% of the Haredi population in Israel today is under the age of 14. 70%. It's a high figure. Kein yirbu. So nitzachtem. If nitzachtem, it means you have to take responsibility for the society. You can't have a minority supporting a majority. You can't have a minority fighting for the majority. Everyone has to pitch in their own way. So Lapid said, you are a victim of your success. That's a new situation to be in. But he threw down the gauntlet, and that's why you have the tumult the last couple of years. He said, you can't abstain from the army. It's a new situation. We're running out of non-Haredi Jews. We're not running out of Arab enemies. Someone's going to have to do the fighting. You can't have a mercenary army. So the question that he raised, and that's really on the table today, is how does the Haredi community transition from a minority status to a great extent, not completely certainly, but to a great extent, indifferent to the common national good, to a position of leadership? That is the situation that's before us. So we can look at every change in the status quo as an attempt to destroy Torah, Rahman al-Islam. Or we can see the current discussion as an attempt to mainstream the Haredi world into a leadership role, which is where Torah Jews should be. I'm getting tired of presidents and prime ministers who are, and great leaders who are not Torah Jews. It's about time we assume our natural position. Not just Haredi, but Dati Lumi as well. Assume a leadership role, and not just as purveyors of chesed, but as teachers of Torah, and as generals, and as doctors, and lawyers, and businessmen, and scientists. It's natural that every society should have that. It's worth noting that Israel has absorbed Jews from 170 countries speaking more than 100 languages. That's Kibbutz Golios. So who said Kibbutz Golios was supposed to be clean and simple? Where does it say that? It's more like Tevas Noach. It's Noach's Ark. Min HaBehema HaTorah U'min HaBehema Sharenena Torah. You have everyone coming in, all right? Different backgrounds, different Ashkafos. Many good Ashkafos and bad Ashkafos. But Noach didn't say, to the horse, stay outside, you're tummy. You got to come into the... You have to come into the Teva also. Well, the Novi say, Yirmiyahu, And this pasuk really summarizes our world. Hineni mevio sam eretz tzafon. Navi says, God says, I will eventually bring you from the northern countries. Vikibatstim miyakasei aretz. I'll gather you from the ends of the earth. Bom iveru fiseach. The blind and the lame. Harav yoledes yachtov. The woman who's pregnant and just gave birth. Kahol gadol yashuvu heina. A great assembly will come back. Who's coming back? Yeah. Some are pischim. Some are limping because they don't have the Torah to give them strength. Others are ivrim. They're blind because they don't see what's right in front of them. They don't see it. Others are harav. They're pregnant, meaning they're latent with potential. They're geared to act, to flourish, to build. And others are yoldos. They already gave birth, and they're making their contribution, and the land itself is flourishing. A person who would say that Kibbutz Golios is not happening has a lot of explaining to do, because rapidly the Jewish world outside of Israel and outside of America is closing down before us. There are very few Jews today, Baruch Hashem, who live still in oppressed countries. Almost all Jews today outside of Israel, in Israel too, but outside of Israel, live in free countries. We spent the better part of 2 millennia in oppressed countries. Aliyah today, for the most part, is from free countries, or it's from countries where they have, you know, new tsaros happening, like in France, or Ukraine, or Venezuela, etc. But even then, something new. Even there, in all those countries, Jews who wish to leave can leave. Nothing is stopping them. And soon it will be our turn as well. That's Jewish history. So how then do we all get along? And if we can't have Achdus, I think we can, by the way, but if we can't, so how do we lessen the tensions and appreciate everyone? So that's Vayichan Shom Yisrael Neged Ahar Kishecha Belev Echad. Vayichan means encamp, but there's another word hidden in there, and that's the word chen. What's chen? Chen we interpret as grace, but it's really likability. Likability. Finding something likable in every Jew is a very appropriate endeavor. There is something that's worthy of appreciation in every Jew. There's much to find. In his beautiful pasuk that Zechariah ben Ido, the Novi, said, it's in Perek Ches, Ve'ela devarim asher ta'asu. This is what you should do. Well, it's all Jews to get along. It's the beginning of the Second Temple era. Dabru emes, ish Israel, speak the truth to each other. You know, these disputes, they're within the family. Right, you can't say the absolute truth even to family, but you could be more honest with family than with strangers. Dabru emes, ish Israel emes, umishpat shalom, shiftu b'sharechem. You'll have truth, and you'll have a peace with justice in your gates. As the Gemara darshens that pasuk, shara, but you could have emes, and truth that even can coexist with shalom, sometimes uneasily, but it can coexist. But the next, that pasuk is famous. The next pasuk is not as famous. The ish es ro'as chavero al tachshavu bilvavchem. Don't think in your hearts what's bad about your fellow Jew, what he is missing, how she's deficient, how they could be better, you know, more like me. Ish es ro'as chavero al tachshavu bilvavchem, the Novi said. There's always bad to find, but don't think it. Look for the chen. Look what's good. Ushvu asheker al tehovu. Don't swear falsely. What's the false oath here? Swearing that these Jews are the worst ever. No, there's no hope, and we're falling apart. That's shvu asheker. It's not true, because what unites us is so much more prominent and powerful than what divides us. Ki es kol eile asher sonesi nu'um Hashem. What does God hate? God hates people saying outrageous, wild things about other Jews. And especially God hates, the Navi says, people always looking for ra'as chavero, for the bad in other Jews. That's not good. That's a bad... We're all talented at that, by the way. But it's a bad talent to have. We should lose the talent. And try to cultivate a new talent, finding the good in all Jews. Rav Kook wrote, there are many different Jews in the world, different strengths, different types. He said famously, Hayashan yitchadesh, vechadash yitkadesh. The old, we have to renew. The new, we have to sanctify. It's all true. We have to always see bitovas chaveirenu, the good in our friends. Someone said, I heard this in Israel a few months ago, someone said the problem is that too many people define themselves by their common enemy. Who are you? I'm not like that. All right? That's no way to look at the world. I'm not like him. No, that's bad. That's ras chavero. Say what you have in common with him, with her. Between the Haredim, whether it's light or not light, Dati, Lumi, all the others. The bottom line is, everyone has the same goals. Everyone wants a state now. The fringe minority does, but everyone wants a state. Everyone wants an army. Everyone wants Torah. Everyone wants Kedusha. I dare say, not everyone, but I think most of the Torah world would love if Halacha was the law of the land. Mina katzela katzed. Not everyone, of course, but I'm sure most Jews would want that. The disagreement, really, is on means, on tactics. It's not on goals. Everyone agrees on the goals. So therefore, we have to look at what the goals are and focus on them. We know that real enemies still surround Israel. Whether it's Iran, radical Islam, not so radical Islam, it's all there. But for us, I think there's something else we should keep in mind. And to me, at least, is always a great source of strength. I was davening mincha here, and I looked right in back of me, and what do you see here? You see the 12 tribes. We're not all one tribe. We're 12 tribes. Each tribe, each shevet, had its own flag, had its own symbol, its own color even, because each represented a different govan, a different facet, a different aspect in terms of service of God. There's a Torah for everybody. But there's one tribe that emphasizes Talmud Torah, and another Chesed, and another Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, and another writing Sfarim and providing matzah and lulavim, etc. Every tribe has its own characteristics, all right? Its own essence. But what did Yaakov Avinu say? Ish kevir chaso berach osam. Each of the tribes was blessed with what was unique to all of them. I mean, if one tribe emphasized one thing, it wasn't just concentrated in that tribe, but it was scattered amongst the other tribes as well. And that's what we need, to look at the strengths that exist in all the Shvatim, because that's what we are, basically. All the groups I mentioned are just different tribes. We need to see the strengths in all those groups and try to absorb some of those strengths for ourselves, and then try to strengthen the weaknesses that each group has. And that's how we grow the people. Rav Kook said famously on the Memra, we say in the davening every day, I hear in the exile, we just say it on Shabbos, Talmidei Chachamim Marbim Shalom Be'olam. All right, the Torah scholars increase the peace in the world. That's usually good for a joke, you know, a chuckle, people laugh. Rav Kook said, you can see the Ein Ayah, it's the end of Maseches Brochos. He said it's because peace comes not through suppression of ideas, not through thinking the Torah is monolithic, as if there's only one way and one tribe. Peace comes through the multiplicity of opinions that exist amongst Talmidei Chachamim being heard. There's no one group that's going to be perfect, that has the way that ensures Jewish survival. In fact, what do we find when we cross Yam Suf? How do we cross? The Mechilta says, Nechlak l'shnei masar gzarim. there were 12 different bridges. Each tribe had its own bridge across the Red Sea. Why its own bridge? Maybe the tolls were different. More traffic, less traffic, shorter route, better scenery. The bottom line is, each tribe had to be saved in an individual way because each tribe relates to God in a different way. The Torah is the Torah. The Torah binds all of us. But each tribe emphasizes a little different aspect of Torah and is committed to Jewish national life in a different way and adds a different nuance to the common wheel. That's what the Shvatim represent. That's why we have Shnei Masar Shvatim. If we're missing one Shevet, there's a great chisaron. There's a deficiency in Jewish life. We need all 12. We need all 12. Understand then that Talmidei Chachamim Marbim Shalom Ba'olam is not a chuckle. It's a bracha. It's an aspiration. And I have no doubt, if we only strive to look for the Tovas Chaveiro, for the good in every Jew, then we'll not only make for greater unity in Jewish life, but that itself will pave the way for Bias Mashiach Tzidkenu B'mehera B'yameinu. Amen. I thank you all very much. Questions? None. Okay. Any questions? Yes.
If they are 70% of their population is children, what is the population percentage of the non-Haredi population as children?
I don't have the statistics in front of me. The worrisome statistic, if you didn't hear the question, what's the percentage of the rest of the population? So I said clearly, let me explain it like this. There is in Israel now, I didn't discuss anything about the peace process, for many years, for decades already, and still lingering on the left, is the notion of the demographic threat that exists, that the Arabs will someday outnumber Israeli Jews west of the Jordan River. For the last 10 years already, it's been a canard, all right? Haredi population declined somewhat in its fertility, for whatever reason, but Haredim in Israel produce per family a little less than 7 children per family, down from close to 9, over 8, about 10 years ago. So that's the most. Dati Lumi families, about 5 children per family, okay? But here's the thing that no one knows. The Arabs of Israel, including those in Yudan Shomron and the citizens of Israel, now have close to a negative birth rate. They're right around 2. Their fertility dropped tremendously for reasons tied to modernity. They want to be part of the modern world. The secular Israeli woman, Baruch Hashem, now produces close to 4 children, about 3.5 children per family. Way up from what it was 20 years ago. Okay? Way up. Now, just to give you an example, I was listening to a lecture about 2 months ago, Professor Guy Bachor in Israel, and he was explaining, he's a demographer, explaining these statistics, and he said it's fascinating, because we don't usually associate the secular Israeli with being prolific. They weren't always, but the last decade and a half, it picked up. He said that in California, today there's a negative birth rate, 1.4 children per family. Replacement rate is 2.1. So they did a survey in California, why aren't they having more children? So the leading answer was what they call in Hebrew, mimush atzmi, self-fulfillment. They want to have careers, you know, they want to live a little. They asked the same question in Israel. Why are they having so many children? 3.5, 4, 5, up to 7? The answer was, same thing, mimush atzmi, self-fulfillment. The Jewish woman feels fulfilled having children. So there's a rise in the Jewish birth rate generally. There's a decline in the Arab birth rate, both within the borders of Israel and the surrounding countries also. Turkey's in a free fall. Iraq, of course, in a free fall. But it's changed. So therefore, the Haredi numbers are greater. So I'm not saying it'll be the majority in 20 years, maybe 30, 40 years, but the numbers are picking up generally all over. So that's a good sign for Klal Yisrael. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Are there leaders in the Haredi world and leaders in, let's say, the Dati Lumi, outside of the political sphere, that actually get together and discuss issues related to Torah and national life and, not being part of the political world?
Right. Let's put it like this. You want an honest answer?
Yes.
It doesn't happen as often as it should, all right? Part of the issue, I remember this arose like 2-3 years ago, was Mi Barosh, who's coming to visit who, all right? And that became a major sticking point. But there's no doubt, there's consultation today, but there's missing, there really should be. You know, if I ran the world, I would do this. There should be more crossover between yeshivas. All right, we'll cross over. I mean, you're learning. Go learn in Merkaz for a day. Go learn in Mir for a day. Go learn in Shalvim for a day. Go learn. A couple of years ago, I got from my shul a 2-week learning allowance. You should try that, by the way. I went to Israel, and each day I went to a different yeshiva. All right? I went to a different yeshiva. I went to Hebron. I went to Yerushalayim. I went to Shalvim. I went to Mir. I went each day. My fantasy was, I just blend right in. When I got there, I realized I'm 30, 40 years older than everyone else sitting there. Why is the Zeta with us today? But nonetheless, very enjoyable. In each place, the Shir is all very nice. There should be that type of interaction more. There is. I just heard a story not long ago. A bunch of Haredi boys spent the day at Merkaz just learning, and within a little surprise at the level of the Torah there, and they got into Milchamta Shel Torah within just a few minutes, which is the way it's supposed to be over the Daf Gemara. So there's not as much consultation. I think part of it is now intertwined with the politics of it, and there's also repercussions, public repercussions if. Not so much in the Tilumi world, but in the Haredi world, if you associate with people that you're not supposed to associate with. So that has to change. I think it's really a media phenomenon, by and large, and it should change. But there is interaction. The bottom line is, you can walk into any shul in Yerushalayim, right? And you see Haredim, Datilumi, Ethiopians, Moroccans, and everyone is davening together. And that's the way it's supposed to be. Yes?
His life, let's say, and the life of his grandparents. I see within my family, and the average Israeli, I would believe today is a lot more connected to Am Yisrael than his grandfather.
Yes, the question was, is the average Israeli today more connected than their grandparents? I think in that generation of the grandparents, there was much more animosity towards Torah. Either arising from a socialist ethos or simply in the wake of the Holocaust. It's hard to sustain that, all right? Like, for example, I don't mind saying, I don't think Yair Lapid hates Torah. I don't think he understands Torah, all right? I think he just has a different conception of society. I'm not afraid to say his father hated Torah. His father was, I met his father once. His father, just Nebuch, was a victim of the Holocaust and never recovered from it. And he was just filled with antagonism. The son's not like that. He just grew up in a different environment. He didn't grow up in Europe. He doesn't have that same antagonism. The average Israeli, by and large, and again, ignore the media, the average Israeli is very well disposed towards Torah. All right? Very well disposed. They just want to know that it says something to their lives. All right? So I was with someone today, he's a journalist, and he told me this story, that he lives in Israel, and he works together with the wife of the mayor of a large city, I want to say who, completely secular, for Dore Doros already, and secular, I won't say with an edge, but so she asked him, he told me, 2 years ago, before Sukkah, so you building a sukkah? She said, of course. Yeah, you eating the sukkah? He said, yeah, every day I sleep there also. So she, then they worked together in the same office, and he was always reluctant to bring up these issues. And she said, he said to her, do you want to know? What, you want me to answer you seriously? You want to have a discussion? She said, yes. He said, it doesn't make any sense to me. You sit in a sukkah because thousands of years ago they sat in the sukkah. So he said, no, that's not why I sit in the sukkah. I sit in the sukkah because it's tachas kanfei hashchina. You feel the divine presence. There's an element of akara satov, that here God's protected us from dorei doros, brought us back to Eretz Yisrael. It's a celebration of Eretz Yisrael, like the Rambam says in the Mor, the Dal Minim, etc., etc. She said, wow, I never heard that. All we were taught in school was that the Frum do this because they did it thousands of years ago and made no sense to her. Wouldn't you know, this woman and her husband, who's still the mayor of a very large city, came to their house for Sukkot, Chol HaMoed. First time they sat in a sukkah, maybe in their lives, if not decades, because there's an openness to it. They want to feel attached to their heritage. That's why I have an interesting phenomenon. I just wrote about it not long ago. You have in Israel the secular Beis Medrash, all right? And I've seen some of, yeah, maybe you saw Ruth Calderon and her maiden speech in the Knesset. So a few of these things. I mean, I'm not entirely sanguine about it because if you learn Torah, it's not min hashamayim. It loses something, and it's the arrogance takes over. It's not really Talmud Torah, but nonetheless, as the Medrash says, "Hamaor shebo yachzirim lemutav." It could be anybody who learns Torah. Maybe the light of Torah will illuminate them as well. But nonetheless, you'd be surprised. I mean, imagine a secular kollel. All right. Based medrash. People come out at night to learn. They're not religious in the least. They just want to learn Torah because to them that's the cultural heritage of the Jewish people. Now, is there a chasm between perceiving the Torah as the cultural heritage of the Jewish people or the religious heritage of the Jewish people, Morasha Kilas Yaakov? I don't think it's a chasm, okay? There is a divide though, and you have to cross that divide. But nonetheless, it's a better place to be in than, you know, just going to the theater or something, or drinking the night away, or doing nothing, just sitting in a coffee shop, wasting time. It's a higher madrega. Such a thing could not have been anticipated 30, 40 years ago, that they would do that. So, I don't know whether good things will come of it, but I can tell you, I hope good things come out of it, because at least the dialogue then is overtone. Yes?
There
are rumors like that. Does the animosity transfer the settlers? There are rumors like that, but I think it's all politics. The bottom line is, because Israel's governmental system is a little odd by American, even by European standards for that matter, the party that's out of power becomes very bitter and threatens recriminations, etc. So when the Haredi parties were in power, they're giving themselves money, their institutions, etc., they didn't care as much about these settlers. And now, by you doing a different way, so now they're going to get the settlers. The bottom line is, whenever there's another election, it all depends on who gets how many votes. And if each of their needs is satisfied, then they'll be able to make do. I'd like to tell you, I can't imagine for a moment that the Haredi parties, I mean, Aguda did not, Degatar did not vote for the disengagement, the expulsion from Gaza, but Shas did by and large. So I can't tell you whether that'll happen again. I hope it wouldn't happen, that all Torah Jews should unite around Eretz Yisrael. I would assume that would happen, but you can never tell. But I think it's also just tied to politics. It's not really personal, and I don't think it carries over from one election to the next. Yes?
Maybe I missed it, but in America you couldn't speak about the Jewish groups without including Reform and Conservative, to whatever extent you want to. You discussed Zionistic, anti-Zionistic, and non-Zionistic.
Right.
Where do the Reform Conservative,
right, so I touched briefly on the secular Israeli, all right? the bottom line is, without belaboring the point, the reform and conserve movements in Israel are essentially moribund. They're not factors in society. Again, they're media factors, like Yair Lapid said just the other day, this week, we have to recognize them and bring them at the mansion, give them money, etc. You're talking in a country of over 6 million Jews, you're talking not even 20, 30,000 people. I mean, it's a minuscule group. The party, there's a party in Israel called the Green Leaf Party. They have one agenda on their platform: legalize marijuana, okay? They get more votes than there are reform and conservative Jews in Israel. So it's a fringe element. But again, by the way, you should know, the Masorati, which is the conservative Jewish movement in Israel, they're much more traditional than the conservative movement here. So for example, I spoke about this a few months ago, the Masorati movement in Israel opposes driving on Shabbos. They're wrong, responsive, so they're against it. Okay, so here, of course, we know what happened here. So they're much more traditional because they cater to different clientele. But in most of society, what's their main issue? Egalitarianism. It doesn't really resonate with the average Israeli. Again, outside a certain fringe. So those things I like to call Haaretz issues or New York Times issues. It's not part of the real world. But the media makes it seem as if it's something dramatic or profound or a source of great acrimony. You could live in Israel for decades and not really encounter any type of acrimony regarding treatment of reform or conservative Jews. They're just not that big a factor. Yes?
I recently read Ari Shavit's book.
Right. Right.
And I couldn't help but juxtapose the fact that last week's Jewish Week had a segment, a full hour, about luxury living.
Right. In Israel.
Apparently for wealthy Americans who are about to make Aliyah.
Right. That's the question. That's the question. So just to repeat it, in case it was not picked up, question related to the figure of 22% of Israelis living below the poverty line, contrasted with the luxury residences being built and sold, etc. It's true, there is a significant poverty line in Israel, but it's a natural poverty line. It's almost exclusively limited to the Haredi and Arab populations. The reason being, the Haredi adult percentage of the workforce, or said a different way, the percentage of Haredim adults in the workforce hovers in the low 40s. Okay? Because of that, Israel's adult participation rate in the workforce is about 62-63%, which is one of the lowest in the industrial world. Okay? In America, it's close to, even with all the downturn here, it's still in the high 60s. So that's what it's from. I mean, I studied economics. I'm not a great economist nor a great philosopher, but the way I was always taught, if you don't work, you will be poor. And somehow that equation plays out in real life too. If you're not going to work, you're going to be poor. If you're relying on welfare or charity, etc., you're not going to be able to make it in society. So it's not cut out for that. That being said, the apartments, the residences that you are referencing are more of a reflection of the affluence of American society, Western society, but Israeli society also. It's not only for Westerners. I will say, though, that there is a housing problem in Israel because the average builder would rather build one apartment, say, and sell to an American for $1.5 million than to build a building that he has to sell, you know, piecemeal. It's much more lucrative. So because of that, housing in Israel tends to skew towards the more affluent part of the community or to people who don't live there, which is the problem. You know, there are many places in Yerushalayim now that are essentially ghost towns, but for the Regalim. I personally know a place where a makolet closed because nobody lives there from Pesach to Sukkot. No one is there. So it's a problem. The government is dealing with that in a very forceful way. People will say, with some justification, it's never as quick as it has to be. And you can't build overnight anyway. But they're dealing with it, and the government is giving tax breaks to contractors to build moderate-cost housing. Hence the controversy. One suggestion was not to charge VAT to young couples getting married. This is Lapid's suggestion. Except for those who don't serve in the army. Guess who he had in mind, all right? But the court already said that's illegal, you can't do that. So finding other ways to give tax breaks to contractors and to purchasers to ameliorate the housing shortage in Israel. But there is a housing shortage. You know, people would rather build something that they could sell for millions than for thousands. That's also Economics 101. Yes?
Just to follow up on that, there have been some very recent articles talking about Haredim becoming more integrated, especially in the high-tech field. I think there's something in the journal.
Yes, that's right.
And their unemployment rate, or their employment rate actually, has climbed about 6%.
Right, more Haredim in the workforce, right? And this goes back to the question you asked before. A lot of it takes place, you know, sotto voce, so it's not well known. I mean, I visited myself the Nachal Haredi base a couple of years ago. They doubled in size since then, and they're oversubscribed for this year. And they put on for me, you know, a very nice demonstration, seizing a house. You know, they had to capture terrorists. Very efficient force. They won the Yechida Mitztayenet last year. Outstanding unit. They won the Chief of Staff Award, the Nachal Haredi Netzach Yehuda. So kol hakavod to them. So you see, it does happen. I think there's more support beneath the surface than we'd otherwise think. There's a lot of shrillness above the surface. And no one wants to be motzi laz on anyone who said don't serve or don't work or don't study. But the bottom line is most of them don't want to be poor, do not want to be dependents. They want to be good Jews living Torah lives, supporting their families, doing mitzvos, learning Torah, serving Hashem. And on that basis, I thank you all very much.